Welcome to the Archives of the Loralee Show, conversation for exploration, timeless discussions to challenge and expand our worldview. And while you may find our guests fascinating, the views expressed may not necessarily reflect those of our own or of the Cuyamangue Institute. That's why we call it Conversation for Exploration. And join in our ongoing live events, interviews, our own presentations, and much, much more as we go exploring. Learn more at CuyamangueInstitute.com and Loralee.com. Welcome to Conversation for Exploration. Hi, I'm your host, Loralee. Well, in one's worldview, a world without science and scientific principles just isn't possible these days. On the other hand, a world without acknowledgement of some creator, some grand design to it, is pretty untenable. So we're left to reconcile our faith and science for ourselves. Our society isn't doing such a very good job about it. And it's very interesting, very instructive to hear about the journey of reconciliation from others. And one of those who has a lot to add to this story is Peter Russell. He has traveled to India, studied meditation, Eastern philosophy. He's done the whole science thing and has earned degrees at Cambridge University in computer science, also in theoretical physics, experimental psychology. He's the author of the Global Brain series, and he's here today to tell us about his most recent reconciliations of science and spirit. He joins us from San Francisco, where I understand you're on a houseboat. How fun. Hi, Peter, and welcome back.
Hi. Yes, I'm actually on a real boat.
Oh, a real boat?
Yes,
just sitting there.
There's a subtle difference, but a houseboat is like a floating house. This is a boat that's being converted into a nice living space.
So, well, you're ready for adventure, aren't you, that way?
Yes.
Tell me a little bit about your history and how you started on this quest.
Well, it sort of crept up on me slowly. I started as a scientist in my sort of youth, and I thought I was going to be a scientist. I loved science. I really started as a mathematician. I loved it, and that was my calling. And I rejected anything to do with spirituality very early on. I think it was about when I was sort of 12, 13, I went through the normal process of confirmation. I was brought up as a regular sort of Church of England Protestant, which meant you sort of went to church once a month or so, and that was deemed to be sort of good enough. Like, everybody did it, but didn't really think about it. And then the process of confirmation, I realized that things like the Nicene Creed, which people chanted in church on Sundays, I was actually meant to believe it. And I just realized I couldn't. And there's a choice between what the church was telling me and what science was telling me. Clearly, science was the way. So the next 10 years, I really had very, very little interest in anything to do with faith or spiritual matters. And I went off and I was specializing more and more in physics. And as you said, I went to Cambridge and I was studying theoretical physics there. And after about 3 years, I began to realize there were some very fundamental problems or issues that physics was never, ever going to answer for me, and they were to do with the human mind and human consciousness. And I think that's what really started me off in this area, is beginning to look at the whole question of what is consciousness and how come that the universe, which physics says starts from hydrogen and evolves, how come it got to this point where it can look back on itself, where I could actually, you know, be doing the mathematics of hydrogen. So that was really the starting point for me, realizing physics wasn't going to tell me anything about the human mind.
Right, if you have just a bunch of matter out there swimming around through eons and eons, where does the consciousness part of the equation, how did that ever get entered in?
Exactly, and that's the big, big question. It still is the big question for science and philosophy, is there is nothing in anything in physics or biology or chemistry that says that when you put, you know, groups of atoms together or living cells together or whatever, that you're going to get this thing called consciousness. By consciousness, I mean having an interior experience. According to current science, all that goes on in the brain should go on, so to speak, in the dark. There's no reason why we should have a corresponding subjective experience with it. And that became, for me, the fascinating question. And that led me off away from physics, initially into psychology, well, initially into philosophy, and then into psychology. And then that's what took me out into my interest in meditation and Indian teachings.
You have a wonderful quote by George Wald. Matter has reached the point of beginning to know itself. Man is a star's ways of knowing about stars.
Yes. There's so much depth in that. I mean, a star's way of knowing about stars. Every atom in our body came from a star that was here before the sun was here. And we now know this, that our atoms were creating these big supernova explosions, which then condensed into the solar system and the planet. But every atom we have has been around for billions of years.
And it's through the death of those stars that the seeds of life arose,
exactly,
the seeds for the next generation.
Yes, yeah. And that's what's so fascinating. It takes these stars to go through their cycle and then blow up in these huge explosions to create the elements that are needed for life. If that didn't happen, the universe would be so simple there'd be no life. It would just be hydrogen and helium and things. But to get carbon, you need these huge stellar furnaces to create it. So we are stardust in a way. We are stardust that has condensed into this beautiful organic form. And then we can look back on the universe. We can study supernova explosions. We can look at how we were created. We can look at how life seems to have evolved on this planet. We can look down into the depths of matter and begin to understand what's happening in the atom. So it's in that sense that we are a star's way of understanding stars. We are, another way to put it is, we are the universe's way of becoming conscious of itself.
Many people explain God by saying, well, what's God going to do with just God? He created us so that he'd have some company and to also expand his own consciousness and experience. We're all those droplets of the grand ocean out there.
Yeah, but that's certainly one way of looking at it. I'm not, more and more these days, I don't see God as something which is external, but I see it as something which is the essence of everything. But I think there may be some truth in that, in terms of how, if there's a purpose to the universe, and this is actually coming out of some modern physics these days, if there's a purpose to the universe, its purpose is to know itself, and to know itself fully. And so you could say that human beings are one particular way the universe has found to know itself.
What is the modern physics that is supporting that idea?
It comes out of something that has the unwieldy name of the anthropic principle, which basically means, if you translate it, means sort of human-centered principle, and which is probably not a very good title for it at all, but it comes from a findings that have been going on the last 20, 30 years, that if you look at some of the constants of nature, things like the mass of the electron, the charge on the electron, the strength of the gravitational force, things like this, that there's probably sort of 20 of these things in physics, which are just numbers. You know, it just turns out that the mass of every electron is exactly the same. And they're just numbers. But what scientists started discovering about 25 years ago was, if you started changing these numbers, if they were slightly different, the universe wouldn't work. For example, if the gravitational force were just 1% stronger, then the universe wouldn't have expanded. It would have collapsed in upon itself in about 4 weeks. Instead of being around for billions of years. If it was slightly weaker, the universe would have expanded so fast that no stars would have ever formed.
So it's like the Gaia principle only applied to the universe at large.
Exactly, exactly. So it seems that the universe is set up, and there's many, many things like this. I mean, the gravitational field is just one example, but there's lots and lots and lots of things like this, which suggest that the universe... Well, one way of interpreting it is to say the universe is set up so that it is stable, it can evolve, so that life can evolve, and so that life can evolve into intelligent beings such as ourselves who are capable of observing the whole thing.
To support consciousness as well. And what are the chances of that, Peter?
About one in a zillion.
So that helps to support that it's designed.
Right.
Not just random accident, it's designed this way.
Well,
and who designed it then would be the question.
Yes.
Universal mind of some sort on some level.
Yes, I almost feel to say who designed it is sort of
Making it an external entity, whereas we are just part of that universal intelligent mind.
We are part of this great happening.
The web of life, yeah. So you said numbers early on was a huge attraction to you. You were fascinated by them, and they do give you that sense that everything's okay. It all fits into what you call a cosmic jigsaw puzzle. Mm. So that's another indicator of that intelligent design to the universe, isn't it?
It is. I mean, mathematics is... I'm still fascinated by mathematics. I don't practice it anymore. I don't do it. But it seemed to... Well, the way I saw mathematics was there was this underlying sense of laws, framework to the universe that was nothing to do with human beings or human consciousness. Mathematics isn't something that human beings invented. Mathematics is something human beings discovered. And I would say any intelligent species anywhere in the universe would discover the same mathematics. They might use different symbols and things, obviously, but the basic mathematics, I think, is universal. It's underlying the whole cosmos. And that I found so beautiful. And some of the equations in mathematics, I mean, the most universal of the equations turn out to be the simplest and most beautiful of all.
Can you give us an example?
Well, there's one. It's hard to understand, but it involves just three quantities, which is, it involves pi, which is, you know, the ratio of the circumference of a circle to the radius of a circle. It involves a number called E in mathematics, which is to do with compound interest. It's the rate at which interest evolves and gets, you know, or anything that grows exponentially. The E stands for exponential. It's the magic number in any exponential growth. That's growth, like, it goes faster and faster. And then the third number, which is a completely weird number, which is in mathematics called I, which is the square root of minus one, which is something mathematicians had to create. And it isn't a real number, but it's something it's a concept. And you then have this equation which says the letter E raised to the power of I times pi equals minus one. Now, what is fascinating about that equation is, first of all, why should three numbers which have absolutely no relationship to each other end up with this very, very simple connection? And secondly, it turns out that basic equation is the essence of any wave motion. And it turns out that every phenomenon that happens in the universe can be described as some sort of vibration or wave motion in the final analysis. So that equation actually, that weird equation, underlies everything that happens. And it's often said, you know, in a mathematician's life, there comes a moment when they come across this equation. It's usually when you're about 16, 17, 18, you come across this equation and your jaw drops. And it's happened to many, many mathematicians. It's like, what? How come? It's like, if there's a design or something else going on in the universe, it's in that equation. As I don't expect most of the listeners can understand it, but it's just, it is a very beautiful and simple thing that mathematicians discover.
And yet even the I, the square root of minus one, being a invented concept, it's not out there in reality.
Right.
Could that just be a substitute for some principle that is out there in reality that has the same value that we haven't yet discovered?
I think so, yes, because it comes up again and again and again in mathematics. And once they invented this number, this imaginary number, it turns out it's absolutely necessary to do mathematics. You can't do mathematics without it. In terms of the complex understanding of what's going on in the physical world, you actually have to have this number. So it's fascinating that something that isn't the number as we think of it is absolutely essential.
So your progression from rejecting faith to now finding, gee, there are some principles in the sciences. I can turn to the sciences to support my belief in a higher order, a higher creator.
Well, that's what I was thinking about 30 years ago, that somehow science would be able to explain consciousness and the fact that we can do all this understanding. And I started looking to the brain. I got more and more interested in the human brain because it seemed that consciousness was clearly something to do with the human brain. And I changed from physics. I left physics behind after a lot of thought, I finally decided that wasn't where my real interest was. My real interest was in this whole question of what is the mind, what is consciousness. So that's what took me into psychology. I did a degree in experimental psychology. And I should point out that experimental psychology is different from clinical psychology. Clinical psychology is the study of people, you know, who have some mental, whatever you want to call it, disorder that needs some treatment or other. Experimental psychology is just the study of the normal functioning of the human brain, things like memory, perception,
creativity,
how the brain controls the body, all these sorts of things, attention span. And I was fascinated by that. And yet, at the end of the course, I'm not sure the word consciousness had been mentioned once. Well, I knew an awful lot about the brain and how neurons work and what different areas of the brain do and how they interconnect and all of this stuff and the chemistry of the brain. But this whole question of why any of this should ever give rise to an inner experience was not touched upon. It was just left as, it wasn't even left as a mystery. It just wasn't even really mentioned. It was just ignored.
But there are other folks who spent many thousands of years studying that very question. No wonder you went to the East.
Yes. Yes, that's what I realized was these were the people, these were what I call the inner scientists. These are the scientists who didn't try to discover what was happening by sticking electrodes on the outside of the brain. These were people who'd sat down and gone inside and explored consciousness firsthand. And these are often what we call the mystics, and they're the great saints, yogis, meditators, things like this. And you find them in all cultures as people have done this, but the East, particularly India, has a tradition of really valuing this sort of inner research of quietening the mind and looking within. And so I realized that this was probably where, if there was anything that had been discovered about the nature of consciousness, it was in the East and in Indian philosophy. And at this time, I'd also started meditation myself, realizing that this was the real research I had to do, not so much sitting in a laboratory, physical laboratory, but sitting in the laboratory of my own mind.
Unlock that inner doorway. What sort of meditation did you start out with?
I actually started doing some Buddhist meditation, some Tibetan Buddhist meditation, and some Theravada Buddhist meditation. But then after about a year, I came across TM, Transcendental Meditation. And that just clicked for me. It was one of those things, you know, certain things are right for certain people, and that just, it just worked for me. I just got off on it. It made sense, theoretically, and I was able to really begin to quieten the mind and dive deep within. So that became my focus. And it still is. I mean, now, whatever it is, 35 years later, I still see that as my primary meditation, though I do various other sorts of meditation as well as adjuncts. But I still consider that technique is my primary way of just quietening the mind.
You also went to India. Tell us what you did there.
Yes. I went out to India mainly to follow this interest in meditation and Eastern philosophy. I went out, first of all, to be with the Maharishi Mahesh Yogi, who was the person who really brought Transcendental Meditation out of India to the West. And this was in 1969. I went out to India, and I spent about 3 months living with him in his ashram in the foothills of the Himalayas, which was in itself a fascinating experience, both in terms of doing long, deep meditations, and that was part of his goal, was that we should really begin to have long periods of silence where we could really begin to experience what many of the great teachers had experienced in meditation.
Did it work? Did you get there?
I don't know where there is quite, but I got somewhere. Yes, I certainly experienced deep states of inner stillness and many of the classic experiences that people describe in terms of the inner silence.
The oceanic oneness.
Inner light, yes, that oneness, that deep, deep sense of calm and knowing that this sense of calm is what you've been looking for all along, but been looking for it in the world outside. And I just began to realize that this was not only the mistake I was making in my life, but the mistake that the whole of our culture is making, that what we all want ultimately is to be at peace. We want peace of mind. We want to feel okay inside. And that, I think, is completely natural. And what our culture tells us is, if you're not at peace, you need to go and do something, buy something, get some new experience. But
fill that void. Uh-huh.
Fill that void by doing something outside yourself, by changing your world, your experience of the world in some way. So you change what you do, what you have, who you're relating to, whatever it is. But the belief says, if only I can just get things right out there, I'll be happy. And, you know, it works for a short time. We go and buy ourselves a new jacket or something, and we feel wonderful for, you know, whatever it is, a few days or weeks until the effect wears off. And what we don't see is the reason we feel wonderful is because we've actually stopped wanting something. It's the wanting something that actually gives us discomfort. And when we stop wanting, we feel okay again, and then we start wanting something else. And what I saw was it was that wanting that was disturbing the peace. When we turn in to look at that, you know, we may call it the void because it feels like it's an emptiness, a nothingness. When we really turn in and get in touch with that deeper sense of who we are, which feels like nothingness, we actually experience it, this sense of fullness and peace and love. And it is satisfying in itself, and that takes away a lot of the need to keep on grabbing the world, taking things from the world, changing the world. So it releases us from a lot of what I would now call abusive activity. I think we abuse ourselves, we abuse each other, and we're certainly abusing the planet in this belief that if only we have enough of the right things, we'll be happy. So just experiencing that was one profound shift for me. And I think that really started off the rest of my life, because I realized there was something to spiritual teachings after all. And I began to see that there was this core method that was Indian philosophy, Buddhism, Christianity, Taoism, Islam, Judaism, whatever it was, there was a universal teaching to do with how we confound ourselves, how we limit our own thinking, how we get caught in this materialistic way of thinking, and how we miss what is lying deep in ourselves. And I realized that this was probably the most important thing to bring out into the world today, that we were driving ourselves and the planet basically towards destruction because we got caught up in this wrong way of thinking.
And because we not only gave such little value to the inner experience in our society, but we actually made it a near criminal act early on, misunderstanding it, calling any sort of altered states a psychosis, trying to categorize it as mental illness for so long.
Yes.
Made
yes.
it dangerous to go there.
Yes, and I think partly because our materialistic Western science couldn't understand what these people were saying.
I also think, though, that our whole society is predicated on progress more and more and more. We're consumers, not citizens yeah. anymore. And if everybody was so happy and contented, then you wouldn't be out purchasing and driving around and doing all this stuff. It would be bad for the national gross product,
yes,
you know, for progress.
It would be.
I don't think it's
a conscious conspiracy, though. I don't think people are sitting around saying,
no.
We mustn't let people realize that they can be happy on their own. Because the people who are doing this, the advertisers, the marketing people, are as unconscious as the rest of us. We've all fallen into this trap. But I think you're absolutely right. If we
all laid down our jobs and went out to go be sannyasis, you know.
Well,
although in Tibet, you've got a whole lot of people who were supporting a whole lot of
yes.
priests, and that was a little bit top-heavy there.
Right.
Yeah.
I'm not one to suggest we all, you know, stop our jobs and just go and sit in caves. The world wouldn't work. We need to do...
Nor does that process work for everybody anyway.
No,
it doesn't work
for
me.
I'm not like that. I like periods where I go on retreat for maybe a week or 10 days, and I find that very nourishing. It's a very important part of my life. But then I want to come back and bring some of that wisdom, silence, insight into the world with me so that I can actually be more, I can enjoy what I'm doing more and be more efficient. Because sometimes when I'm caught up in this doing mode, I actually lose touch with who I am, with what I'm doing. I get totally focused on do, 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 do.
There needs to be a balance there.
There needs to be a balance. And it's about, I think most of us are, we're meant to have active lives, but have this balance. And but it's about doing the actions, the things.
Informed by the silence and by the spiritual values.
Yeah. It's having both together. I think that is what is important.
And we will continue our conversation with Peter Russell. His book is From Science to God, The Mystery of Consciousness and the Meaning of Light. And we'll get to the light part when we come back. We'll be back for more conversation. I'm Laura Lee. Let's get back to our conversation with Peter Russell. His book is From Science to God, The Mystery of Consciousness and the Meaning of Light. And Peter, let's get back to reconciling faith and science and doing so within the context of the observable universe and the context of our daily active lives. It should be there. If it's everywhere, it should be there as well. So do you think past societies have done this? Has anybody, you know, really accomplished this, a good balance of integrating what they do with the understanding of working with nature and harmony with nature?
Yes, it's whether any culture has done it is difficult to say, because the records we have of past cultures, you know, it's difficult.
Sketchy and broken.
Yeah, and also how we translate them and what they actually mean. But as far as individuals go, then I think we can definitely say yes, we can find records of thousands and thousands of people in all cultures across history who've had these deep inner awakenings. And these are the people, you know, we typically call the saints, the mystics, the wise ones. They've woken up in one way or another, maybe just through grace or through years of meditation or whatever their path is. They have woken up to what seems to be a common thread, is the awareness that deep within is this source of peace, love, security, and that in some ways this is the divine within us.
The light.
The light. The light of consciousness, the light of God shining within each of us as our own innermost self. And that that level of consciousness is something we all share. It is universal. And that's why I think many of these people, they start talking about this in terms of, I feel at one with the cosmos, or even, you know, I am divine, I am God, which gets people into a lot of trouble with the church, because you know, they say, well, somebody else said that a few thousand years ago, we can't have two people saying that. So it's considered blasphemy. But I think when we realize that what they're saying is not I as an individual, but this deep, deep sense of beingness, the sense of being a conscious entity that we discover when we still the mind and dive within, is divine in itself.
See, I look at history and I go, okay, you've got a religion that says that consciousness is part of the equation, just like time, space, and matter, because, you know, God would be that supernatural being.
Yep.
Consciousness there. Then we come into a science in which consciousness isn't part of that equation. It's just all what you see is what you get. You've got to see it. You can't see a soul squirm under the microscope, so let's just put consciousness and the soul off to the side here, and let's pay it lip service because that's part of family value, but it's not part of our scientific equation. So now the leading edge of science and the insistence of people who say, you know what, this is my experience and my experience has to match what my intellect is showing me. Let's put consciousness back into the equation. But this same society, Western society, went out and started to decimate all of the indigenous peoples who did see consciousness as the fundamental part of the equation more important than the rest of what the science holds true. You know, let's wipe those people out. And what did they, how did they inform their societies? How did they structure them? How did they carry out their daily business? All in harmony with that. I mean, so where are we today and where do we go from here and how can we reconcile our past and our past actions? And we're still now in the name of economy, we're going out and decimating right. the rest of the indigenous cultures that
yes.
have managed to survive.
Yes.
You know, what's wrong with us?
Well, I think what's wrong with us is we have lost contact with this level of consciousness, and that's affected both science and spirituality.
Oh, yeah. And then we have to say, gee, you know, meditation is such a foreign thing to do. This was a few decades ago. And drugs, oh, heaven, say no to drugs, even though many of them were the same substances that early people used to get in touch with a religious experience. You know, oh, we're going to see them as wrong. I'm not supporting drugs. I don't
right.
take them. I'm just saying that they have been a well-worn avenue
yeah.
towards spiritual experience used in that context. So, you know, it's like we're closing all doors possible.
And I think this sort of spirituality, which is, say, has been so abusive of other people, if you're not with us, you're against us sort of feeling. And we have the right version of the truth. Anything else is wrong.
We've cornered the market on God, and you better listen to us.
Exactly.
And let us control you in the meantime.
Yes.
Yeah.
To me, that isn't what spirituality is about at all. That may be what happens with religion as it gets what I call churchified. It becomes a dogma in itself and a closed-in system of thought. But that to me is not what spirituality is about. Spirituality is much more the personal awakening to the depths of one's own being. And I think science has fallen into almost the opposite trap. It's cut itself completely off from consciousness. And so you have a worldview in science today that says, all that is real is that we can see, hear, touch, the world of space, time, and matter.
And if a scientist really wants to be good, he's got to be objective and not be subjective, not do the meditation,
exactly.
for example, to explore consciousness. Let's
yep.
just stick to those electrodes on the brain.
Yeah. And yet, you know, that science, which believes in the material world is the real world, that is the science which has so much problem accounting for the fact that we are aware. And so you have this strange paradox. That the scientists walking around, the one thing they know for certain is that they are experiencing beings, experiencing the world, and yet there is nothing in their science that can explain it. So in a strange way, I think scientists would be much happier if there weren't such a thing as consciousness. But then if there were no consciousness, there'd be no science.
They'd be out of a job.
Well, I mean, science comes out of consciousness. That's the paradox. It's through our being aware and observing the world, and then beginning to draw conclusions from our observation
yeah.
that we have science in the first place, and yet that science says nothing at all about the fact that we are observing the world.
And it says nothing at all about the extrasensory perception, which is all consciousness. You know, no, only we can build the test tubes and the microscopes and the telescopes and get beyond what can be seen readily. No,
yes.
Can't do that in consciousness. That's just silly. That's just superstition. That's
yeah.
just pathological thinking, you know. Gee, but it's our experience.
Yes. Well, I think this is the next big step for science, and we're not there yet. Most scientists are fully, firmly rooted in the materialistic worldview. But I think we're at the beginning of a huge paradigm shift, a huge shift in worldview, which is going to end up saying we have to accept that consciousness isn't something which is created somehow by all these cells in the brain, but somehow consciousness is. It is absolutely fundamental to the cosmos.
Well, actually, you can reverse that. You could say that all those cells in the brain and all those cells everywhere, living cells, are created by consciousness.
Yes.
Created it as convenient vehicles to carry itself around in the material realm.
You can say that, yes. And another way in which that is true is that they are all experiences. When we think of a cell, it's a concept we have in consciousness. If I see a cell in a microscope, the image is something that appears in my mind in consciousness. That in a way, all we ever know are the thoughts, the images, the feelings that appear in our mind. So from that point of view also, mind consciousness is absolutely fundamental. And this is something which I think you find, again, in Eastern philosophy and other metaphysical traditions, this idea that consciousness is fundamental. That's what they discovered through their own inner explorations. And what I find most interesting of all is, if you accept that as a hypothesis, that consciousness doesn't come out of the brain, consciousness is something that's fundamental to the cosmos, it doesn't actually threaten anything in contemporary science. Physics, mathematics, biology, chemistry, all of these things work exactly the same. It doesn't threaten anything, but what it does...
Oh, it does threaten something, though, before you get to your point.
It threatens your belief system.
No.
Oh, what does it threaten?
It threatens the status of science. You know, we've so conveniently pushed God off the top of the pyramid so we could sit there alone. Gee, we're humans. Yep. You know, aren't we just the epitome of creation? Don't we know everything? Aren't we just going to play God down here and muck about with everything and not pay attention to nature and consider her just one more female to be raped and conquested, you know? And so when you put consciousness back in, then you're automatically opening up that there's a higher, greater power than we ourselves. So we have to really take our place back in the web of life as part of the web of life, not sitting at the top of the heap of it. You know, we'd like to go around building those pyramids so we can sit on top of them.
Yeah.
At least you guys do.
Yeah.
But that's another story. Go ahead, Peter. So it does threaten science in a sense. You know, I want to know everything. I want to be the dictator. I want to be the one. It has to go through me. You know, they're the new priesthood.
Yeah. Well, it threatens.
I want to corner our consensus on reality here, and, you know, I want to be the one that says so.
Yeah. It threatens our attachment to science and our beliefs
about science.
What I meant was it doesn't actually threaten the laws of physics or chemistry. The actual discoveries don't change, but it threatens, it challenges the whole way we use science and the whole way we live our lives.
And it could answer a couple of those questions, like just how is it that the mass and the charge of electrons and the strength of the gravitational force field are so perfectly designed to maintain a universe that's living and evolving?
Yes,
you know,
yes.
Could answer those kind of questions.
And I think it also answers some of the fundamental questions in things like quantum physics, which is how does the observer affect the reality? We know in quantum physics that it's often the act of observation which seems to crystallize reality out and give it a firm form.
I also understand that there's experiments where the timeline, you know, the past and the present can and the future can interreact. I understand there's scientific experiments that would demonstrate that, or effect at a distance. You can also start explaining some of those puzzles.
Yes, I mean that this stuff is all quite new, and it's always a bit dangerous to make any clear statements because next week someone will do a different experiment and something else will happen, and everybody will turn their eyes.
Then it'll start explaining how scientists are affecting the results of their experiments.
Yes.
Yeah.
But what's being discovered recently is this thing which is called non-locality, which is what happens to a particle in one place actually has a direct correlation with what is happening to a particle somewhere else. And all this seems to be beyond cause and effect. And I think what this is beginning to show us is the ultimate nature of physical reality is nothing like we think it is.
So science, sorry, but you've just been looking at one little tiny piece of the puzzle, not the whole grand thing. That'll put science in its place. It's one tool in the toolbox, not the entire toolbox.
Well, also, you see, science, in the true sense, doesn't say anything about what it should study or what is real. Science is the observation, and from that observation, drawing conclusions, checking them out with other people.
You've got a set of fundamental assumptions. You know, Newton, the father of physics, started out as a mystic.
Yep.
We may not translate his astrology, but he wrote it, and he started out assuming there was a spiritual dimension to the universe, there was consciousness, there is a God, and let's go explore his handiwork as a means of getting closer to him. If you have that as part of your set of assumptions, you do it in a very different way than if you don't.
Exactly. And this is what I'm saying. There's nothing in science that says what set of assumptions we should start with.
Oh, good point. Okay.
So you can start with a materialistic set that says space, time, and matter are real and consciousness isn't. Or you can start with another set of assumptions that says consciousness is absolutely real and we can do science in the mind. I can observe phenomena in my own mind. I can draw conclusions. I can check them out with other people who meditate, for example, and say, you know, do you find that when the mind becomes very quiet and you put your attention on whatever it is, your heart, do you notice certain qualities of experience arising? And you say, oh, yes, I notice that too. We've done a scientific experiment. It can't be, you can't put a stopwatch against it or weigh it, but it is science. So I think science can be applied to the inner just as much to the outer. And the problem is not so much in science, but in materialism, which is the mindset, the belief system that says, this is the real world. And that's what we're challenging. Not so much the process of science, but the materialistic worldview.
Okay, good distinction. But that materialist worldview says what we can observe is the only thing that exists. There's wonderful inroads to be had looking at materialism if you realize it's just one side of the coin.
Yeah.
Okay. Tell me about the meaning of light in your studies.
This is something I got fascinated by when I was doing physics. That light is the great enigma in physics. It's what started off Einstein with the theory of relativity, the fact the speed of light is always the same, whoever's observing it, however fast you're moving, and that was a problem. And then in quantum physics, the quantum is the photon of light. Light seems seminal to both those big revolutions in modern physics, quantum theory and relativity. And what comes out of those is that light itself is not part of the space-time material world, that when you start examining what these theories say about light is that light has no mass, and from light's own point of view, it doesn't actually experience time. It is in the eternal present moment, and it doesn't experience space. It is here now. So you could say, I mean, Ram Dass's phrase, be here now, applies perfectly to light in the physical sense. And then I started noticing, as I got more interested in metaphysical ideas, that light, we use the word light to talk about consciousness. We talk about the inner light. If someone is unconscious, we say the lights have gone out. Deep in meditation, we see light. There's a sense of bright light or golden light. In the near-death experience, one moves into the light. So light is a theme in spiritual circles, in consciousness as well. And then I started realizing that when you get down to those very deep states of consciousness, if you like, when you connect with the inner light, again, you find that time disappears. You move into that timeless moment. You move into that space of being here now. And I began to realize that perhaps there were some very fundamental connections here between light in physics, which is beyond material world of space-time matter, the light of consciousness, which is also, it seems, beyond that world. And what this means, I don't fully understand, and it may be beyond the limits of human understanding. But my conclusion is that whatever the ultimate absolute is, whether you call it God or the One, the Source, the Infinite, whatever name you give the ultimate truth, it seems that its first manifestation in form, in reality, is light, which is interesting. You know, let there be light was God's first command. And that seems to be true in physics, that light is absolutely fundamental before space, time, and matter come into appearance. And light is absolutely fundamental in consciousness. So it's like the meaning of light is sort of, I'm not even sure we can ask what the meaning is, but it's the significance of light is something, I think, very, very, very profound.
It's interesting, too, how all religious lights include light, you know, the candle, the Christmas trees, all of that, a metaphor, a symbol, an experience, the physics of it.
Yes.
All ties in. We call ourselves the spark of the divine.
And then we talk about enlightenment.
Illumination.
Yes.
Yeah. What does this all mean in terms of the future of humankind? Where do you suppose we're going from here?
Where we are being drawn to is the sort of awakening we've been talking about, that happens to some of the great prophets and sages in history, that's happening on a much more widespread level. I think we have the opportunity now for people as a whole to begin to taste that and awaken to that. And that, I think, is what is happening. I was going to say slowly happening, but in terms of historical time, it's happening quite rapidly. It's happening.
Oh, we get that exponential growth then, don't
yes.
we? Put in a little more of that E factor.
Yes, exactly. And it's like it's happening just over the last 20, 30 years. We are waking each other up. There's this collective process of awakening, whereas in the past, it may have been an individual like Buddha going out into the forests and studying and meditating and fortunately waking up at some stage. We are doing this together, almost like in the forest of life, but we are learning from each other, from teachers, from books, from radio shows, whatever it is. We are all teachers to each other and all learning from each other and gradually, collectively, waking each other up and raising our level of consciousness. And I think that is the direction we are moving in and destined to move in. And the more we do that, I think the more wisdom and compassion we will have in how we relate to each other as a species and to the planet. Now, whether that waking up is going to be rapid enough for us to really deal with a lot of the things we've already set in motion, which aren't nearly so constructive, I don't know. But all I do know is that's the way we should be moving. And so that's what I want to put my energies behind, to seeing that happen more and faster.
To fan those flames.
Yes.
We're all fanning something or other, aren't we?
Yeah.
So what are you going to put your shoulder behind and try to nudge forward a little
right.
bit?
That's the team I want to play with. Because that's the team I think if this team wins, we have a really good, nice world.
So what would, you can imagine politics looking different. You can imagine the sciences looking very different to put consciousness back into the equation.
Mm-hmm.
You can imagine our lifestyles looking very different. How would you map that out? If you were to go in a time capsule, somebody build a time machine and you look at us 100 years hence and that exponential growth did happen,
mm-hmm.
What would it look like, do you think?
What it actually would look like in form, I wouldn't like to predict. It's a bit like the caterpillar trying to imagine what a butterfly is.
Oh, we don't have to be right. We just get to play.
Right. Well, I'd look at it in terms of general terms. I think what it would be like is it would be a world in which there wasn't the fear that we have today. So much of what we do today, we do out of fear, whether it's fear of insecurity, fear of looking foolish, fear of being attacked, whatever it is.
Mm-hmm.
I think one of the common factors that comes up again and again and again with this awakening is that we realize that most of this fear is self-created, unnecessary, holds us back, and stops us experiencing love. So it would be a world in which we didn't live in fear of each other. We lived in love with each other, not in a romantic sense, but just seeing the divine in each other, respecting each other, compassionate towards each other, where our mutual awakening was the goal. And that, I think, would be a totally different world.
Because rather than see, this is a competitive dog-eat-dog Darwinian kind of world, survival of the fittest, you could also put into the equation, well, this is a benevolent universe that has gone to a lot of trouble to make a supportive supportive arena in which for us to live and play. We're part of the web of life. There's a continuity to evolution and life that has gone on billions and billions and billions of years.
Yeah.
And we're part of it. We're part of that whole tapestry.
Yeah.
And so I think we need to know that too. One of the things that contribution that science makes for me is that it goes out and it brings back these principles of how does the world work at large? Therefore, what are these same dynamics at work in our own daily life, in our own inner life, outer life, societal life that informs it? We have to be very careful that we're putting a balanced picture in and a healthy one.
Yes. And then I think we rediscover principles of the inner functioning. I think one of the principles is something we already mentioned, that we all want to be at peace, to be loved. And if you take that principle out into action and say, everybody has this deep need to be at peace and be loved, then you say, well, how can I communicate in such a way that when I share something with another person or what I do to another person, they are going to feel more at peace and more loved as a result of this. What we tend to do in our world is the opposite. We tend to manipulate by withholding love and trying to instill fear in each other. And all that would totally change.
Human relations. Mm-hmm.
All our relationships would totally change. If we just shifted, I think that would be one of the most profound shifts, if we shifted from this fear-based relationship where we are trying to take from other people and withholding love in order to get what we want, to the opposite, which says, rather than take, let me give, and let me give what everybody else wants, which is love, to be at peace. Everything changes. Quite remarkably. I've done that in my own personal relationship.
Tell me a story about that.
Well, just that when you make the agreement that whatever you're doing in the relationship, you're doing, the intention is that the other person should feel loved and appreciated, not disturbed or upset. It's interesting how time and time again in relationships we start withholding love in this manipulative sense. Mm-hmm. When you do the opposite, and it then becomes a skill where you start teaching each other, like, well, I didn't feel very loved when you said that. Say, okay, let's look at that. What happened there? Was it the words I used, or what happened? We learn how to shape what we have to say mm-hmm. so the other person feels loved. When you do that in a relationship, something magic happens. The only way I can describe it is it feels like this love comes down and enters into the relationship, which is nothing to do with one person loving another, but it's this field of love enters the relationship, and it becomes easier and easier to work in this way. And it's so, so fulfilling.
And I've discovered, too, that if I want Paul to do something for me, I don't whine at him. I do something that he wants to have done.
Yeah.
I look around and go, oh, yeah, that would, you know, he notices that and he goes, oh, that was so sweet, baby. What can I do for you?
Yeah.
You know, so then you enter into this spirit of cooperation.
Right.
That you've greased the wheels and all that comes pouring forth. Yeah. So in practical terms, too, you mentioned people withholding to get what they want. You can also get what you want by giving first.
Right. And then you take that principle and say, what happens if we start applying this in politics and in international affairs, where everybody is trying to make the other people feel awkward or suffer in some way or another? What happens if we turned it around completely and said, what if I give my enemy, quote enemy, what they really want, which is love? And that's what I think Jesus meant when he said, love your enemies.
Mm-hmm.
He probably did mean that, see them in a good light, but also love them. Loving someone means caring for them, taking care of them, making sure they get what they want. If you do that to your enemies,
become your friends.
Yes, they don't become. They cease to be enemies. They don't want to be enemies anymore.
They have no gripes, so.
Yes.
Yeah.
And they have gripes because we aren't behaving that way towards them.
Yeah, boy. Well, thank you for those insights, Peter. I appreciate all of your work. And some concluding comments for today?
I would say, just to wrap up what we were just saying, was a wonderful quote from the Buddha when he was talking about right speech. And he just said, if you cannot say something in such a way that the other person feels good on hearing it, it is better to retain noble silence. And then added, while you work out how to say it.
Oh, good one. So choose the team that you want to be on carefully.
Yeah.
Right. Let's all work towards a better world. And thank you again, Peter, for your contributions in that. So from Science to God, a very good read. Good luck in your path. Thanks for joining us. I'm Laura Lee.
Laura Lee Online. www.lauralee.com.